simply testified to by her husband. It's not testimonial. It is a statement. And he is not describing something that's hearsay. He is an eyewitness to that statement. Now, I still think it's a thin reed, personally, on which to take a life in the face of what ought to be a very, very strong presumption of life instead of death. But the two issues here are, one, is Florida right or wrong? I think it's wrong. Second, does it have the power under federalism to make that mistake, and do the federal courts have the right to intervene? And the normal answer to that question is no. That's complicated by the fact that Congress has now moved in and said, in Terri Schiavo's case, and only in Terri Schiavo's case, in fact, the federal court does have a right to move in. This is extremely complicated. This is a tragic case involving a human life, but I have to tell you, as a law professor, it is a fascinating case with rights and wrongs on both sides, and we will continue to teach this case for many years to come.
It's remarkable. Jeffrey Feiger, let's go back. Regardless of what you call it, I certainly know that if somebody were being executed that was on death row based on the testimony of one person, whether you want to call it hearsay or not, the testimony of one person who is an interested witness, you would be concerned. The ACLU would be concerned. Sure. The New York Times editorial page would be concerned. All the people who think that George Bush's actions are wrong would be very concerned. Isn't there some hypocrisy here on both sides?
No. First of all, this isn't a criminal case. And second of all...
Well, so she's even more innocent. So
shut the hell up, Scarborough. This nonsense about you talking about someone being worried about if they were in a capital punishment case, the ACLU would be running out. Look, you and your friends have done everything you can to suppress the rights of people on death row fighting against death penalty cases, unless they're, you know, greedy capitalists. And then again, they don't really get charged with capital punishment cases. But then you have on none other than Dershowitz, who babbles out. I think it's a thin line on taking a life. Please, Dershowitz, you don't care about nobody's life. If it's the wrong color or the wrong religion or the wrong program, you've advocated the U.S. Empire and its barbarians to torture people. If it's after information in the name of a war on terror, right? I mean, please, get the hell out of here, you maniacs. Don't worry about pulling the plug on that woman. It's time to pull the plug on you guys permanently. Slave time, check. Listening to 104.1, 106.7 Illinois, 101.1 Santa Cruz, LUBER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe, and Google Web and Slave Revolt Radio to check us out in the blogosphere, Slave Revolt Time. Tonight, we're going to take a trip into a little confrontation that seems to be going on. Big Oil versus the neocons. Greg Palast's update on the story. And the tragedy of Donahue. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1. Slave Revolt.
Death Watch. The alarm goes off every time they execute someone in Texas.
Wow, it's ringing again.
I know. It seems to go off every few seconds.
The Death Watch. It's alarming.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
Thank you. they have no perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off is going to do to the rest of the planets in the solar system.
You know what time it is. Beyond the Shadow. You know, the current image of the neocons and their little project for a new American century dribble is that they are just running things. Completely all-powerful. Yet some recent events and documents help shine a different light on what's going on within the shadows. This has always been fairly obvious to a certain extent, but this will hopefully put another element to the dynamic of how the financial capital market system works and the class strategists for the rulers who work within it. Recently, Greg Palast has come out with an article and a little piece that was played on the BBC concerning a conflict between some of the capitalist enterprising efforts of big oil and the neocon strategists. We're going to explore that a little bit. And basically a segment that says, neocons, who's your daddy? It looks like the big oil capitalists. So let's check out how Greg Palast outlines what has recently taken place in the land of the capitalist exploitators and their administrators.
One problem we do have sometimes among progressives is to assume that the right wing and corporate powers are all one monolithic conspiracy. Actually, there are a couple different conspiracies that don't exactly love each other. That's part of the story and how I was able to get some of the inside documents. Let me, for example, we have the situation where Paul Wolfowitz has been nominated to run the World Bank. Now, most people would consider that a good deal. In fact, that's seen as a punishment. He's being booted out of the Pentagon where he has real power and now being made to hang out with the wusses and giving back, you know, building dams for the damned and for the poor people. That's really bottom trolling in the testosterone-driven, militarized world of Bush and the neocons. So it's punishment. And what happened to the neocons? Well, Wolfowitz found a wolf with bigger teeth. He decided he was going to take a bite out of big oil, and he got bitten. What happened is, in fact, we discussed on your program, Dennis, 2 years ago when I was able to locate a document, as did the Wall Street Journal, saying that the oil fields of Iraq would be completely privatized, the whole thing chopped up and sold off. That didn't happen, and I was wondering why. So I did an investigation. Sure enough, the group that objected to selling off Iraq's oil fields, surprisingly, was big oil itself, which has lots of objections to a sell-off. The main reason, by the way, is that if you sell off the oil fields of Iraq and ramp up production, which is part of the deal, you are now threatening OPEC. Only state oil companies which can maintain the OPEC quota can be good members of OPEC and maintain the oil cartel price. Now, why does big oil care about that? Well, when you have $56 a barrel oil, as we have this past week, you're talking profits that are like double the record profits that have been earned by oil companies. Shell Oil saw its profits rise 400%. I mean, I think that the industry average is rising 200, 300, and 400% over last year's earnings, which were themselves records because of this monstrous increase in oil prices, thanks to the OPEC squeeze. And the neocons wanted to destroy OPEC because that brings down the power of Saudi Arabia and the Arabian politicos. And the oil company said, no, you don't go after OPEC. There are other reasons why they don't want privatization of the oil fields, because mainly it doesn't go to big oil companies. It goes to, like, the cronies of international shoplifters like Ahmed Chalabi and his cronies would end up with the control of Iraq's oil fields, not the international oil companies. So they didn't like that idea at all. So they put their foot down and said that the neocon plan has got to go. And now, who told me that the oil companies put the kibosh on the neocon plan? Well, the former head of Shell Oil, Phil Carroll, who was the CEO of Shell USA, was one of them. And he was, most people don't realize, he was actually put in charge of Iraq's oil fields. We weren't going to exactly leave Iraq's oil fields to the Iraqis now, were we, Dennis? So we had the Shell Oil. We had a new plan written up, which would call for a state ownership working with big international oil companies, a plan written up by Amy Jaffe of the... Stan, I would look wider to the... It was an entire crew of industry people. By the way, the report was ordered up by a guy named Bob McKee. Bob McKee was the senior vice president of Conoco Oil, and then he was assigned to run Iraq's oil ministry by Bush after the guy from Shell left. I mean, you have to understand, we don't let the Iraqis control their own oil. That's left to Texas oil men. By the way, this guy McKee earned $25 million from Conoco. The last year he worked there before he was appointed by Bush to Iraq. I mean, so I think that rather than just look at the institute, what you have to look at is the industry's view.
So what in part seems to be playing itself out is that, you know, as a Paulus outline, you have different forces within the spectrum of capitalist, imperial expansionism and domination that have their own particular interests, strategies, ideas about how to go about it. It's not that they're against the capitalist system or anything. They just have different levers and different spheres of compadres and constituents that they wish to serve for their own particular interests, but it's still within the interests of monopolistic capitalism, financial, global capitalism and expansion, which ties into imperial endeavors, war, domination of resources, exploitation of workers, etc. So the neocons basically wanted a form of individual privatization within Iraq across the board, meaning businesses, oil, all of the stuff that you can imagine within the spectrum of the Iraqi economy. Now, the big oil industries, who are privatizers themselves, but they are privatizers within their spectrum of their corporate domination. And what they found is that this whole OPEC type thing has basically and tied into Saudi Arabia is a racket that's bringing out extreme profits for them, because you have the OPEC, which is tied into the capitalist system, that as it's rooted within the capitalist system brings in huge amounts of profits, because you have various societies, you know, like Saudi Arabia, which basically are just little fiefdoms that the workers don't control the economy in Saudi Arabia. The workers don't have at this time the control over the destiny of how the product that they're slaving over to produce out of the ground is sold out into the world market. That's all within the spectrum of those who are playing the little capitalist game. And the big oil industries have found that within the whole OPEC monolithic construct, they're able to reap incredible sums of profit, as Paulus outlined, 200-400% profit just for over last year. And they were making profit last year. So if this were to be broken up, and all of a sudden you were to have Chalabi and all of them give some to their friends, and then they were to work outside of the spectrum of OPEC, i.e. overproduce, flood the market, stuff like that, they can cause the oil profits to go seizing down. In other words, this is about maintaining control over resources in the same way that the imperialists know that they're not getting all the capitalist imperialists in America. They know that they're not getting and will be receiving all of the oil that is produced out of the Middle East for themselves in America. No, they're using their control over the oil and resources to have an effect, a controlling effect for their capitalists and competitors over in Japan, Russia, etc., etc. So to make OPEC vulnerable, or to have an entity that is has the second largest reserve of oil in the planet, and allow them to then start producing like mad, that would send the OPEC monopoly and control of how much oil is produced out of the ground, or at least distributed throughout the world. It would send it in a tailspin. So big oil said, no, we ain't playing that. We want our profit. So this is not about them being anti-imperialist or anything like that. It's just that they see it's more to their advantage to, one, keep Iraq within OPEC, maintain the stabilization of OPEC, maintain the stabilization of Saudi Arabia, and whoever they have to throw up, you know, to be in control of kind of a monolithic type of fiefdom of the resources in Iraq. That's more or less the model that they want. Now, what this also kind of exposes also is that, see, you can see how the neocons, because the neocons are, you know, kind of tied in with AIPAC, you know, the Zionist lobby, and they do want to weaken Saudi Arabia, because, you know, from their particular interests. And those who are within that little, you know, movement, they want to have people gain more influential economic power and control and all of that. But when big oil came in, it didn't matter. It didn't matter that they had AIPAC, the Zionist lobby, behind them. It didn't matter that they scribbled down all of the documents in the Project of New American Century. It just got pretty much slapped down and exposes, in a sense, where some of the real superpower within the capitalist framework belongs.
Yeah, Tracy has basically touched it off, but what's so important is that we not get carried away with this Greg Palace report, but at the same time understand its value. The ruling class is not one guy. Let's take something real simple, like profit, right? When the average person talks about profit, unfortunately, because we are so miseducated, we don't really understand what profit comes from, and indeed the profit is just a small part of what the working class generates. The working class, right, comes in and works. It takes whatever values that it works with, and it creates surplus value. It creates more value than existed when they started putting their labor into a certain enterprise. Now, one, the working class, of course, creates enough value to feed itself. But what else does? Out of that surplus value, the capitalist has to pay interest on loans, rent. He has to pay for his constant capital, his machinery, stuff like that, right? And whatever's left is what we call profit. You see? This is where you get a problem, because if the bankers are charging too much interest, then the capitalists don't want to borrow money. They don't want to expand production by borrowing more money. If they're charging too much money, so that's the way interest can affect. If the rent, all right, if they're charging too much money on ground rent and space, well, then the capitalist is going to stall on expanding once again. So here, different sections of the ruling class very much are in competition, or let's just say, not necessarily direct competition, but there is a certain amount of friction between them.
They have certain spheres of influence that they want to promote.
And there are some contradictions between their interests. It's not quite, it's not, the capitalist class is not homogenous. And neither is the working class for that sake, but much more among the capitalists, there are distinct interests. So you have the problem, let's take big oil. Look at this a minute. When you have big oil, most companies have a board of directors, right? A lot of Americans may not know this, but the people in big oil sit on the board of directors of General Motors. Well, what happens if you get people from big oil sitting on the board of directors of General Motors? It means that you don't get a carburetor that can produce 90 miles a gallon. That's what it means. Because big oil wants to sell oil. Doesn't matter if you need it. Doesn't matter if it's good for the environment. They want to sell oil, period. So right there, that conflict is built in and actually holds back technological development in this particular case when we talk about making a better automobile with less pollution and using less gasoline per mileage. It's big oil that stands directly in the way of that progress. So we talk about monopoly, free enterprise. You hear people talk it all the time. Oh, this is a free enterprise. Well, that's just a product of ignorance, because the monopolies have so taken over the economy of the United States, you can't even buy a damn hamburger anymore. I'm talking about a sandwich without dealing with a monopoly on some level. Today, I'm driving to get my prescription. What I want to get? Medicine. Where'd I have to go? Pharmacy. Where's that? Long's. What's that? Monopoly. That's a chain. Well, hell, I'm hungry, man. I think I'm going to run get a sandwich across the street. What's there? Kentucky Fried. What am I going to get? The Snackers for $1. What's going on there? It's a chain. You see? Where can you go where you don't have to deal with monopolies and these chains and stuff? Well, not this side of capitalism, my dear friends. And this is a part of the problem. Go ahead.
Next, Greg Palas outlines how Big Oil said basically to Paul Bremer, "Who's your daddy?"
Oh, I mean, first of all, you had actually Paul Bremer, for those who have thankfully forgotten who this character was. He was the scamp who was head of the Civilian Provisional Authority. Basically, in other words, he was our Pasha viceroy in Iraq running things. And Bremer had been managing director of Kissinger Associates. And he had a very neocon, ultra-free market view of what to do with Iraq. And he was pushing for privatization of everything, privatization uber alles, including the oil field. But then the adults came in. Phil Carroll of Shell Oil flew into Baghdad on a C-17, now Houston to ultimately into Baghdad, got off the plane and told Bremer exactly the oil facts of life, which is that there would be no privatizations, no sell-offs, and that the old Baptist hands at the oil company would be kept in to run the thing, and that there would be no messing around with the status of Iraq as a good member of the OPEC cartel. So basically Shell Oil's former executive laid down the law. He left and left it in the hands of the ConocoPhillips man. Now, I should also mention that when Bob McKee, the ConocoPhillips man, was there, he had given up his oil company position, or his Conoco oil position, but he maintained his chairmanship of a subsidiary of Halliburton Corporation, which is very interesting. Because he was chairman of the Halliburton Corporation subsidiary while he was the U.S.'s official guide for the Iraqi oil ministry. Very interesting business here. So what's happened is that they said absolutely no to these neocon plans of privatizing oil. You want to privatize the banks, you want to sell off all the state's assets and their electric companies and their water systems, go ahead. You keep your hands off big oil's oil in Iraq. And the way big oil controls oil on this planet is not by owning the foreign fields. They have profit-sharing agreements in which the locals own the fields, but they take suck up the profits, and any threat to that system is going to be very career damaging, as Mr. Wolfowitz just found out.
So once again, this outlines kind of the dynamic within the capitalist imperial sphere that took place. You have a neocon Paul Bremer, you know, whole part of that whole little neocon type movement and stuff, and they had their specific ideas. It's still within war. It's still within imperial intervention. It's still within destruction and theft of other people's resources. But the same way that they are trying to privatize everything, you know, the electric companies, the water systems, the banking systems, the same way that they flipped the way that Iraq sells its oil from euro back to the U.S. dollar is the same way that they wanted to basically do to the oil fields for their particular goals and motivations. As I mentioned before, you know, to damage OPEC, to weaken Saudi Arabia's influence, etc. But big oil stepped in. The big capitalists stepped in and said, uh-uh. One of the top shale oil guys flew in and said, no, we basically want the Baptists to have a similar type of overlord authority that Saddam once had. And we don't want these things parsed out so you can have Chalabi and his friends or whoever you guys want involved in these privatized schemes just pumping out oil like you're Jed Clampett or something. We ain't playing that because it's going to hurt our particular interests, i.e. profits. So whatever interest and things that you guys may have behind your sleeve that goes outside of the spectrum of what we have in store, it's just not going to be tolerated. And it's interesting as many of these things have taken place and the documents that they have laid out. On Greg Polis has a website that you can go to. It's gregpolis.com. And he has some of the actual documents that he has, like Annex D, Scope of Work, Privatization, Assessment, and Support. And it outlines the particular strategies and things that they have had in plan. So my whole point is that you've had, of course, like the project of the New American Century, and those neocons have their particular strategy. And it's all about imperialism and stuff like that, but it has their own particular self-servant types of world views and stuff. But you also have big oil in their particular interests. And big oil straightened some of that stuff out, at least for now.
You know what? I was just to show you how pervasive this problem with monopolies really is. Recently, the price of steel shot through the roof. And as an electrician, I have to buy steel pipes, so I buy rigid pipes. How much can a two-inch piece of rigid might have cost, $12, you know, a couple of years ago. Now, that same piece of pipe, Exact same. They're charging as high as some places $60 for one piece of rigid pipe. How do they do this? Well, you see, not only do they charge the increased price, but these monopolies like Home Depot start to post price the stock in hand. So they may have bought some rigid that costs $12 a stick, but because the present price is $69, they post price all the rest of it. Yes, they do. No, it's not illegal. They can do what they want. It's their stuff, their stores, their world. You know, you start to see Home Depot done run everybody out of business. All of the small mom and pop hardware stores are either out of business or really struggling for their lives. So what's the consequence of this? Well, I'd start checking out, because I tell you the truth, I go to Home Depot all the time, and less, but I admit, I go there, you know, take care of business. Well, they have laid off more than one-fourth of their staff. So you go into the store now, and there's nobody to help you. So when you go into Home Depot, you can count on spending minimum 1 hour. Well, no, is that really a bargain? Yesterday, they had a giveaway thing. They were selling a tool belt that normally sells for $80 for $20. If I didn't have three or four tool belts, I definitely would have bought the tool belt for myself. I don't need five tool belts. At a certain point, you start to figure these things out in life. But the fact of the matter is, while the tool belt is at the cost of, let's say, one piece of rigid pipe, of EMT conduit, let's say three quarters, $3.79. That is three times the price it was 2 years ago. So what they do is they raise the price on some objects where they figure they're the only ones that got it in the area. Other objects, they can lower the price almost to cost or maybe even below. And through playing this game, let me tell you, these people get theirs. They be getting all of theirs, their profit, at our expense. And then there's no union. And they lay off one-fourth of the staff, so you get lousy service. Let's figure this out.
Now, next, Paulus outlines the effect high oil prices have had on the national and international scene.
Now, there's two things I'd like to point out here. One is that this administration, despite the fact that our economy is being absolutely hammered and the world economy absolutely hammered by these high oil prices, the estimate is that we've lost 1 million jobs in the United States to high oil prices. That's the OECD figures. 1 million jobs lost, and yet our administration is backing a policy in Iraq to make sure that there is no threat to these high OPEC oil prices. Now, according to the insiders, the decision was made by Dick Cheney. So Dick Cheney is running our energy policy on a protect OPEC basis, even if it means chopping off the political heads of his neocon cronies at the Pentagon. The second thing is a story that is related that I break here in both Newsnight, BBC, and in the Harper's story, that the State Department was planning the invasion of Iraq within two or three weeks of the inauguration of George Bush in 2001. This is before any September 11th attack, and this is when the administration was still saying that they had not discovered so-called evidence of weapons of mass destruction. In fact, was saying that Saddam was no threat, and yet there was a plan of invasion being planned. It was quite different than the one we see now. This was not the neocon plan and the huge occupation we have now. Bob Woodward wrote a book in which, you know, there's a bunch of gossip about how Colin Powell opposed the invasion of Iraq. That is not true whatsoever. The State Department had simply a competing plan for invasion of Iraq, which involved an invasion which would look like a coup d'etat, but backed by the 82nd Airborne. Saddam would be removed, an old Baathist general would be put in his place, and nothing would change except the guy at the top. So in other words, we knock out Saddam and a couple of his cronies and his sons, and basically the kind of terroristic Baathist regime would change, would stay in place at least for a while. Jim Baker himself, who was Secretary of State, and of course had actually authorized, told Saddam through our ambassador that he could invade Kuwait, but he just went too far. He's supposed to just take the oil field thing. Jim Baker said, we don't have a problem with the Ba'athist regime. We have a problem with Saddam Hussein. And therefore, the old State Department hands just said, just get rid of Saddam. Now, there are, you know, let's face it, Saddam was no sweetheart and should have gotten, you know, no one's going to cry about his leaving. But what is significant here is the idea that it wasn't just the neocons that were out to get with a plan for invasion, but without the United States being, the United States public being told, you know, plans for war were afoot from the early stages of the Bush administration. It had nothing to do with September 11th, despite what our president says. I mean, September 11th was still in the future. And that's a very important thing to understand. And yes, people know about the neocons and the project for New American Century, but this was a different, this was the kind of State Department establishment headed by a woman named Pan Quan Rood. Pan Quan Rood, National Security Council, which is headed by Condoleezza Rice at the time, and now she is a, and she's an expert for the State Department. Now, you have to understand, there's some fascinating intrigues in this whole story. Robert Ebel used to be the CIA's oil chief, oil expert, and now is at a big think tank in Washington, where he works at Madeleine Albright and others, was assigned to babysit Ahmed Chalabi in London before the invasion. And Chalabi was very much for privatization because, according to four or five sources we had, is that this was a possible route for massive corruption. He'd already picked out the crony small oil companies to get the fields. But what was interesting is that Paul Wolfowitz sold the war, not just on the basis of weapons of mass destruction. He told Congress that the reconstruction of Iraq, instead of costing $100, $200 billion, would cost nothing because there'd be so much oil we could pull out of Iraq that the war would pay for itself, in effect. It would be a free ride into Iraq. Now, you could say he was over-optimistic. You could say he was wrong. But the information I'm getting now is that this may have been perjury, because I spoke to the people that were feeding data to him at the Pentagon, to his operation at the Pentagon, and what he told Congress did not match what his experts were telling him. Now, when you're told one fact and you testify to another, you know, in my old field of racketeering investigations, that's called fraud. That's called perjury.
So once again, Paulus outlines how this is how you can't have liberal fantasies and illusions. He outlines and shows the documentation, once again, that you can punch up on his website, the State Department's planning for the invasion of Iraq. This is before 9/11. Which is not part of the neocons' little project of a New American Century program that they were to set up and had set up. They had their whole thing that was tied in with the whole big oil stuff. And they were going and planning on pushing this through regardless of a 9/11 hit or whatever. In other words, the world is going to continuously keep getting plunged into these imperial genocidal wars as long as the capitalist monopoly financial system stays in place. And they'll use whatever means to justify it. 9/11, not a 9/11, whatever. They'll concoct it, construct 9/11s. They are for perpetual domination in war. This is what they're about. So it basically just worked out that the neocons taking the ball concerning the 9/11 issue, and were able to push through the need for attacking Saddam under the whole war on terrorism disguise was what bursted out of the starting blocks of this imperial endeavor. But as the neocons were running around the track, when they wanted to implement some of their other things, i.e. a breakup of the oil system in Iraq, and a complete privatization where Chalabi and his little, you know, coon friends would be able to just manipulate the oil system and do all this massive corruption and so on and so forth, which would have an effect on OPEC. That's when big oil said, uh-uh, who's your daddy? Get back. We don't care who's backing you. You know, the Zionist lobby or whoever. Get the hell back. And shut up. Shut up. And that's just what happened. Boy George, Dick Cheney started chopping off his neocon friend's head. They all got in line. They shut the hell up like they were supposed to. It was just a hardcore reality check. And because big oil wasn't going to play around them losing the super profits that they were making. Even if the neocons had put in their whole game plan and say Chalabi was and his cronies were now owning a lot of the oil fields, they would still be making enormous profits. It's not that big oil was all of a sudden going to lose, but some of the vehicles and engines that helped stabilize it from their perspective for their massive super exploitation and profits, i.e. the whole OPEC setup, the stabilization of Saudi Arabia, that would have been undermined. And even though that was the goal of the neocons, it was not the goal in the interest at this particular time of big oil. So they said, who's your daddy? And that's it. We ain't playing this. You know, now you can hoot and holler and all of that other stuff about these guys, but, you know, hey, at a certain point, who is your daddy? So this kind of underscores, and the documentations help bring a lot of this to light that Paulus has revealed on his website, how these things go into place and how we should not often get caught up into thinking that one particular segment of the capitalist crusade is the epitome of all evil. You know, I know it's in fashion for people, oh, the neocons, oh, the project of new American century, and all of that type of stuff. These wretched maniacs continuously and will continuously, neocons or no neocons, as the documents help expose, perpetuate imperial wars, removals, genocide, onslaughts on the masses of people, because the imperial interest of the capitalists is based in the exploitation of humanity. These neocons just happen to be a particular form of administrators for the capitalist class. Our interest is outside of all of their spectrum. And us organizing within our particular class interests to flush down the toilet all of them is the answer. Not to worry about one particular, you know, entity and think that if we vote them out because a lot of them are behind Bush, Boy George, that's going to... Please. Big oil's behind both Boy George and Kerry. The strings are attached from the big oil, from Shell, to Kerry's behind, just like it is Boy George. That's the reality, and that's what Paulus, even though he's not really talking and emphasizing that, but that's what it helps expose, helps bring to light within the reach of the shadows.
So, an administrator, we have to understand now the difference between a class, a regime, a government. You understand what's happening, what we're talking about, y'all? Because this is very important to really get. One time I remember there was an election went on in France, and the chief of police said, yes, elections and the politicians change. But the police remain. The state, c'est moi. That don't change. They don't change the whole structure every time there's an election. You see? And that's very important to understand this whole dynamic that's being laid out here. I try to use Home Depot, simply Home Depot or other, you know, popularly known chains, multi-chains, mega stores, things of this order, because I think you can relate to it. That's what I'm trying to do. So when I say Walmart just paid $11 million in fines to the federal government for utilizing immigrant workers with no papers to do janitorial work. You say, wow, they cracking down on Walmart, $11 million. Walmart is the largest employer in the United States, with now over 1 million employees. The amount of money these people pull in every year by getting the goods made in China, where they're paying less than $2 a day. Those same goods are sold here in the United States at super profit. They don't just make profit. They making super profit. When they get through paying their own workers, and what are they paying those workers? $9 an hour, $8.75. No, they don't pay minimum wage. No, not quite minimum wage. Looks like it may be 75 cents over minimum wage or something like that. But when they get through with that, they are making billions, and I must put the S behind that billions, every year in profit. So let's stop and count this now. If I'm telling you they're making $100 billion in profit, which is something I think I'm pretty close to what, you know, Walmart is pulling in, and they paid $11 million for a practice that they had done for several years, you know, and they finally got called on it. $11 million. What is $11 million when you put it next to $100 billion? Remember, a billion is a million, a thousand millions. A million is a thousand thousands. So we're talking about the 90 league. I want y'all to see this and think about it. And then you understand what we're really talking about here. And this is why we will win in the end. Because in the end, it is almost inevitable that the capitalists are going to fight amongst themselves. They always talk about, oh, the left fight amongst themselves. Yes, we have differences of opinion that have to be resolved, y'all. We got to resolve these differences. But the capitalists have inherent differences that are recurring problems that will always emerge. And with skill and understanding of these differences, we will win.
And that's why the capitalists spend so much time trying to drone the masses out into these artificial types of differences. Oh, they're about to pull the plug on that woman.
Oh, yeah, whatever. I don't know her name. I'm sorry.
And on and on and on. So now you have all these
Michael Jackson.
Right.
Michael Jackson.
Barry Bonds and steroids.
Oh, play, Barry, play. Don't quit.
Role model. Next up, Paulus outlines how the oil cartels are being realigned in Iraq.
That's the point, is that the oil industry will now be restructured into kind of an OPEC-friendly, nationalized state enterprise. The Ba'athist technocrats have been brought back in. They were first put in by the Shell oil man. They were removed and demoted by Chalabi's crew, and now they are back in place. Now, when we say, I want to be a bit careful, when we say Ba'athist, remember, it's kind of like people who were in the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. Just about every major technocrat joins the party. But nevertheless, it's basically the old Saddam crew, and they'll be back in charge. Now the question is, what do the Iraqis get out of it? We don't know yet, they are certainly better off with that than, frankly, than a privatization of the oil fields. In fact, the great irony of this is that the oil companies, to some extent, are trying to protect the Iraqi people a bit, mainly because it's in their interest. In fact, you know, the former chief of Shell Oil said to me, even though he's opposing free market in oil, of course, and he said, you know, we don't have a theology. Oil companies don't have, they don't have any theology. Basically, they have no ethics. They have no principles, per se. They simply have an interest in the bottom line. He was very, very direct about this, and it was kind of refreshing to hear it from him. And in the end, though, it may even be best for the Iraqis, because the rumors of privatization, which has some true basis in the neocon fevered plan, that was adding to the insurgency, because the neocon plans were being basically spread around by the insurgents saying, look, these guys are coming in to steal your oil. Now, it still may get stolen, but in a much more subtle fashion through what's called, you know, these profit-sharing agreements, which may end up being very, very lucrative for international oil companies. Basically, we're going back to Saddam's old oil company setup with one thing. Saddam had actually broken up the oil company into a couple parts because he didn't want any competitors to his power. International oil companies want the entire Iraq oil company put back together. They need the kind of power of the state, the authority of the state, to keep a clamp and lid on the situation in the oil fields, including maintaining that OPEC quota, which, by the way, in the United States would be a violation of law. It would be a criminal offense to conspire to limit the production of a commodity in that manner. But OPEC and the international oil companies' dealings with OPEC been given kind of a pass from the Sherman Antitrust Act.
So once again, Hollis outlines how the things took have broken down and taken place. Big Oil basically wants an OPEC-friendly state enterprise regime. They basically want some of Saddam's old comrades, you know, from the Baathist end. Chalabi, when he first started to emerge, removed a lot of those guys. Shell came in, put them back. Now, and this is all to help stabilize in a state-controlled way for the interest of the big capitalist, Big Oil, in America. Maintain the stability of OPEC, maintain the stability of Saudi Arabia. Now, what can undermine and what is undermining both of these enterprises? The one that the neocons tried to implement in, and what's going on now? It's the Iraqi resistance. It's the Iraqi resistance that is going to be the precursor of an overall liberation movement in Iraq if it's going to take place. The oil interest, contrary to what Paulus was saying, are not trying to protect the Iraqis. They're trying to protect their particular profits at this extremely obscene rate. And if that means not allowing Chalabi to break things up into little fiefdoms and help provide motivation for the Iraqi resistance by saying, look, they're privatizing on an individual level, we have to resist against it, then of course, you know, that's how things are outlined. But at the end of the day, the maturing of the resistance in Iraq, the development of a class conscious resistance in Iraq is what is needed to really put both of these conspiring entities of death, the neocons agenda and Big Oil agendas, where it belongs, in the cemetery.
Yeah, but here we're talking about Chalabi's interest, we're talking about, you know, OPEC's interest, we're talking about Saudi Arabia. The question is, what is in our interest as workers? What is in our interest? Who's looking out for it? Well, number one, let's get to the bad news first. No one is looking out for our interests in this present configuration. All right? We don't have a political party. We don't have a leadership, really, to speak of. But I think I can fairly say that cheap fuel is in the interest of the working class. When oil prices go up, the average worker now today in America may travel roughly 100 miles to work. That is going and coming, 100 miles a day. So obviously, when you're burning up that much fuel, cheap fuel is in the interest of the working class. In another way, it's in the interest of the economy as a whole, is because as the prices of fuel go up, this unfortunately causes a contraction of the economy. Because the capitalists, who have to use fuel in order to run their machinery, have to cut back. You see? So, here we go. We have hostile, contradictory interests, even within the capitalist class. Eyes open, workers. Our day will come.
Hold on a sec. You know what time it is. Ventures in Corporate Media Land. And as we wrap up tonight, we're about to go into a segment, The Tragedy of Donahue. The career trajectory of Donahue's TV enterprise is starting kind of to play out like a liberalized Greek tragedy. Full of confusion, myth, misconceptions, illusions, despair, painful death. You know, on MSNBC, it was supposed to be the Donahue comeback platform. Instead, it was a plank platform at the end of the ship in the middle of the sea, infested by sharks, where the capitalists within that corporate media system basically pushed Donahue off the plank. We're about to explore this. He was recently on Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now! And Amy and Gonzalez go into many things with Donahue on his career and his state of mind and where he thinks the corporate media is in this present day and time. So first off, let's hear what Donahue has to say about Amy asking him concerning the MSNBC memo that basically said, Donahue, we can't deal with this show because while our competitors are flying the flag, this is before the recent Imperial War took place in Iraq. Donahue's show looks like a seed and hotbed of discontented, self-conscious, and self-aware Americanos. So let's see how this transpires. Check this out.
We all learned about this memo just soon after you were fired that came out of NBC that said that as we led into the invasion of Iraq, they didn't want to have their flagship show, no matter how successful it was, the most popular show on MSNBC, being one that provided a forum for anti-war voices. They didn't want an anti-war face when the other networks were waving the American flag.
Right.
Your response?
Well, that memo was a fact, and it was reported by the New York Times and other publications. Our program was doing reasonably well. We weren't Elvis, but the program for its, the numbers of our program on the family of NBC, MSNBC at night was very respectable, and I think had a prospect of growing even larger. So the numbers did not warrant our departure, our dismissal. And along the way, it became clear to us that they were terrified that we were going to become a place, an anti-war kind of platform, where all these radicals would come and oppose the war.
Like Harry Belafonte.
Yes, and others. We had some wonderful Peaceful Tomorrow. I mean, I came back to television and ran right into a wall of widows. I mean, that shocked me. I just somehow wasn't anticipating this. 9/11 widows, the New Jersey girls, and these wonderful people, people who came on, mothers, wives, said, "Not in my name. Don't kill more innocent people to avenge the death of my loved one." And we just were very excited about what we were doing. Along the way, it became clear that they were really very nervous about us, and the rule was laid down. We had to have two conservatives for every liberal. I was counted as two liberals. I mean, this is the truth. This is. So I was very, very naive. You know, for a veteran guy, I can't get over. And there's probably some vanity involved here, too. I thought I was going to be a place where where dissent could be heard. I really believed that that was going to happen. And it was very naive of me to think that. It made them very, very nervous.
Now, this outlines, like I said, the Greek tragedy played out in a liberal-type spectrum. See, all of this type of talk that you often have heard people say that Hollywood, the record industry, corporate media, it doesn't see black or white. It just sees green. This helps expose once again.
Yes, sir.
No, no, no. They have a class conscious interest. Now it's time that many of us have a class conscious interest in perspective of what the hell is going on. His numbers, according to their own rating standards, was doing reasonably well. It had the highest during that particular type of time slot. So it was doing, quote unquote, competing, reaching out, the whole bit. But they were terrified. They didn't like the fact that he was providing a platform for certain sectors of the American population. It's not like he just had on some hardcore radicals or anything. But they were flag waving and still are, and beating the drum beat and throwing out this consistent droned out propaganda, as mentioned earlier. Just honestly take a look at what's going on those networks. All the constant coverage of Jackson, how he walks into the courtroom. Is he faking it by looking despondent? Or is he really sick? This garbage. This is garbage. I mean, the whole world's in a turmoil. Things are going on all over the planet that directly affect the masses of people in this country and throughout the world. And they're running around spending all of this time on idiotic nonsense. Buffoonish, coonish entertainers. This is to soak your mind full of commercialized, celebritized, corporatized, gumpified junk. So, but the part of the tragedy, in a sense, comes in that Donahue himself had to admit he was naive. Here's someone who's had decades of experience
right
within the corporate media spectrum. And he was just walking around with all this illusion because he had his little show going on. That's what I mean by the tragedy of Donahue. When someone in the corporate media spectrum is talking about they want two conservatives for every liberal, and you got punks like Bill O'Reilly and them talking about the liberal media, please, these clowns need a straight up intellectual beatdown, and it's not going to be done within the spectrum of playing their game.
Absolutely not. This is why when you tune in to Slave Revolt Radio, you hear us talk about the head fixing industry. That's why we call it the head fixing industry. Let's look at the memo. No, you're doing fine, but you're not doing fine. Well, what is it? The media is a strange business. Because on the one hand, they certainly do try to make profit. But on the other hand, they're the head-fixing industry. So at the end of their assembly line is a stupefied, gumpified, confused, and unconscious American citizen. That's the aim of the media. That's the number one aim of the media. If you don't understand that, you don't understand what's going on. You can't interpret the foolishness that goes on 24/7. Look, I turn into CNN, this, that. Yes, there are a couple of decent reporters here and there to try to do a decent job. There is even a couple of programs, Link TV. I give them a little, you know, heads up. Free Speech TV tries. You got Democracy Now. A handful, basically, a handful of news agencies that try to put out something approximating the truth. But it's not an accident. You see what we're trying to get across to you? This is the head-fixing industry.
Next, Donahue outlines how his show developed and survived off of issue-orientated stuff. Check it out.
And Donahue, the Dayton Show, how
1967.
You... How you changed, really, daytime talk. What did you do? What was different about it?
Well, we knew we were visually bored. We and television was filled. Monty Hall was on the other channel giving away $5,000 to a woman dressed like a chicken salad sandwich. And Bob Barker was saying, come on down. And people were screaming and yelling. And here comes Donahue with one talking head and a group of women sitting on folding chairs. We had two cameras. It was live. And it soon became... We knew that we had to... And we were in Dayton. So we... You know, celebrities were not on call for us. I had been listening to WBZ in Boston. A chap by the name of Bob Kennedy. No relation to the political family. I remember him so very well. He's no longer with us. But he was fabulous. It was a Westinghouse station, and I could hear it in Dayton. And he was putting on people long distance on the phone. And so I started doing that on radio in 1965, maybe. And so that's what translated to the TV show. And my first guest was Madeline Murray O'Hare, who came on the program.
The atheist who
affected the Supreme Court decision banning the official reading of prayer in school. There's no God, there's no heaven, there's no hell. When you die, you go into the ground, the worms eat you, you biodegrade, and you become part of the physical universe. Well, the building fell. All of Dayton came to a halt. It really was quite a sensation, as I knew it would be. And I knew it better be, or we wouldn't. We were very nervous about how long we'd last, as I say, because we were so visually boring. So we had to survive on issues. And she brought issues. I don't care if you worship a pet rock. You pay for it. I'm tired of paying more taxes because of your churches getting phony tax relief that causes my taxes to... she was fabulous. And also, a very, in many ways, a very, very unpleasant woman whom I happen to really like. I liked her a lot and still do, and... have fond memories of her and sorry about her grim death.
Her grim death? Madeline Murray O'Hare was brutally, savagely killed by probably some hocus-pocus fanatics. Her son, and her granddaughter were kidnapped out of Austin, Texas, out of their Austin,
Texas home. Oh, is
that right?
This has all come out now that they were kidnapped?
Yeah. And chopped up, charred, et cetera, et cetera. So, grim death. But what's fascinating is that how Donahue was talking about back in those times, how he had to survive. And basically, he had to survive off of issues. Having people like O'Hara on, talking about real issues. Now, you see, it's all of this visual stimulization, superficial Gumpify stuff.
Cultism.
Right, you know, sound bites, yelling and screaming back and forth, putting on Amos and Andy shows, loud spectrums. Think of Crossfire. All the hooting and stuff like that. These aren't any kind of intellectual discussions. They're not based off of trying to intellectually stimulate you, based off of real issues. It's all this kind of fake partisan, screaming, hollering, over-talking one another, downgrading the next person if you can't really tackle what that person may happen to bring up, etc., etc. And fortunately for him, also, was the fact that they started off in Dayton, so they didn't have access to all these celebrities, you know, this junk, you know, to get your mind off of real issues. So when you think of Oprah, you know, you see Tom Cruise come on one week, some other entertainer the next. You know, it's just garbage.
Cultist.
And have people worrying about and looking through and fantasizing about the rich and quote-unquote famous and stuff. This is why you've often heard me attack this whole role model stuff. It's not that the role model syndrome does not exist in America, but it's just a negative reflection on society when you have a highly advanced, in some ways, industrialized society that bases so much of its own self-esteem, self-worth, in kind of a perpetual juvenile way of looking at athletes and what have you as role models. So when you hear them talk about athletes should be role models, it should be flipped on a society. What does that say about a society that expects its athletes, entertainers, to be role models? It builds up a certain form of corporatized cult of personalizing these particular athletes so that they could be marketed out and have undue influence on your life. So the next thing you know, you're buying a pair of $150 shoes because your quote-unquote role model has them on and is advertising them for the corporation. Thereby, the corporation marketing strategy, its shoe, like a Nike shoe, ends up being in the image of Michael Jordan instead of its true image as a sweat factory institution that basically has some young girls sweating their lives away working for 31 cents an hour. That's the true face of Nike. That's what should be on Nike, not some swoosh, not some, you know, high-tech commercial. But next, Amy asked Donahue if the media has regressed. Let's check out how Donahue deals with this.
Has the media regressed?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about it. I think we are all, everybody's under pressure to shut up and sing. And dissent is a vehicle of entertainment, really. I admire so much those progressive people who do get on Fox. By the way, progressives are more likely to be found on Fox than anywhere else because they're inoculated against any suggestion that they're anti-American. The people in the middle are the ones who... Michael Moore has never been on Meet the Press. Michael Moore has never been on Face the Nation. Imagine, he was considered Time Magazine Man of the Year. I mean, he was in consideration. The documentary lines around the world, around theaters around the world. Certainly the center of the 04 presidential campaign, this documentary. He was invited on Larry King, but then disinvited when the White House refused to send a balancing act. So the White House, by refusing to send a balancer, was able to control my... He was on George Stephanou ABC, but edited to a fairly well. It was pre-taped and then edited. This is Karl Rove. You put Michael Moore on, you don't get Condi. You don't get Access. You don't get Colin. These are the legitimizing heavyweights. This that grant gravitas to the Sunday morning program. It's amazing.
But
follow the ball cap. You'll know.
Big media companies, though, would argue, and conservatives would argue that obviously with the explosion of cable and all of these other channels now, that there are many more vehicles for shows to get out. What's your response to that?
They do argue that, and it's a chimera. I have the dish. I have more channels than is good for the average man. And they're all selling the Bowflex machine. Or Jesus. Or jewelry. And then if you look long enough, somewhere in the mix, you'll find some wonderful, wonderful ideas. History Channel, to name one. I find myself now, because I was once a member of the gang, I once had a cable show in prime time. It seems like another life ago. I watch Fox, and I watch MSNBC. I'm looking at these personalities with very keen professional and very personal interest, because I used to be there.
So, once again, Donahue realizes and talks about how even from his time, the regression of the little media, corporate media system. And this also corresponds with the expansion of the corporate media. It's expansion into the conglomerate mode of owning and controlling more of the spectrum in TV land, radio land, etc. But if you look at how these types of issues are being dealt with within the realm of bourgeois politics, it's Janet Jackson. It's, you know, seeing a little breast, some profanity by, you know, little knucklehead Howard Stern. See, it's sidetrack stuff, superficial issues. It's not the issues of how the regression of media in this society has been an ongoing development with the expansion of the corporate media and corporate takeover of more and more of the resources of the media spectrum. So all this Janet Jackson stuff is just a sidetrack, a sidebar, basically a way, a diversion to get you thinking in this false dichotomy of morality and stuff like that within the construct that they want you to think of morality. Now, Amy asks, and his final thing on with Donahue, if Donahue felt, and what Donahue felt about the pressure he experienced while at MSNBC. So let's see what Donahue has to say about that. Check it out.
What was it like when you were doing Donahue on MSNBC? When you were doing the show, what kind of pressures did you face there? I mean, if you brought on an anti-war voice, how many pro-war voices did you need?
Well, we didn't realize until somewhere when they got nervous. You know, I was suggesting, why is Donald Rumsfeld calling France old Europe? I mean, why is the Secretary of State a smart aleck? How does this help our troops? How does this help? And we were Well, Donald Rumsfeld, I mean, this was a General Electric property I was on. By the way, somewhere along the way here, I wondered, you know, MS means Microsoft. I often wondered, do Bill and Melinda Gates watch MSNBC? You know, they hired Michael Savage.
That's who followed you.
Yeah. But I'm very conflicted about this. A lot of people who worked for me went to other programs. So I would like this channel to succeed. I'm rooting for Ron Reagan Jr. I happen to like him. I think he's a very informed, civil voice amid all the bomb throwers. And the music. I mean, we literally had the drums of war leading into this. But I was gone before the war, before they reached Baghdad. We were gone.
Were they bringing you into their offices?
No, they brought our... I'm a coward. Marlene Seelip was our EP.
Wasn't she it for Donahue as well?
Yes, she came from...
We're going way
the
back.
Old daytime. Yes, we were all connected at the hip. And, I sent her in.
And what would they tell her?
First, the pressure was to put on Doris Roberts of Everyone Loves Raymond. Let's have some celebrities here. Remember, I had no power, and I was a guy who came from a lot of power. The Donahue Show for years was an 800-pound gorilla, and I was very, very spoiled, and probably brought this vanity to this. That's why I can't get over how naive I was. We didn't have power. We didn't have the audience that allowed anybody to stomp around. So I wanted to save the ship. I remember Stud Strickel came in and he said, "You've crossed the Rubicon." And I thought, well, I don't know. we haven't crossed yet. We're in the middle of some very choppy waters here. And we wanted everybody to grab an oar. And so I felt, let's go there. Let's save the show by not getting uppity. And, you know, well, that's not why I came here. I didn't come here to do God. Bless Doris Roberts. She's a wonderful person. We happened to turn the interview into an interview about ageism and feminism. You know, it was good.
You're incorrigible.
Well, we couldn't kick tires like we did on the old show, and it was tough.
So once again, it just outlines what's really going on when MS. The MS in the NBC stands for Microsoft. You get a clear idea what this is all about and what really needs to be done. Donahue was gone before they reached Baghdad, because before they reached Baghdad, they basically came through his show and did some serious shock and awe bombing of what he was trying to do from his particular perspective. And who did they throw into his place? Mike Savage, their corporate media version of a chalabi. This is the way the game plays itself out within the corporate media spectrum. For them to talk about put on celebrities like Doris Roberts is basically part of the Gumpification program, as I mentioned before. From celebrities to acceptable racists like Michael Savage exposes the savagery of the corporate media system. And for those who are slow to be aware of what the hell is really going on, they'll be part of the tragedy of Donahue. Hold on a sec. Let's just gonna about wrap it up for a slave tonight. It's clear that we can't get caught in the haze and smog of the corporate media system, because all you'll do is go blind. But we'll have to throw our own voodoo child spell on them trickle through their dust until the next time slave revolt. Out.
Lord, I swear the moon turned the fire red.